This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it's a packed conversation hour ahead. Good morning. Do you dress to express yourself? What's the item of clothing, maybe items of clothing, that make you feel like you? We're going to be talking about dressing identity, among many other things, in the coming hour. You'll be joined by someone who's passionate about the idea of dressing as a form of expression. She probably had a head start. She's a model. Kate Bell has been modelling here and internationally since the late 1980s, and it caught my eye. She is still walking the runways. I want to hear about what it's like to be a model on a runway into your 50s, and she has a wonderful take on how we should all use our wardrobe to express ourselves. So stick around for that conversation. It's sure to be great. But also tell me, what are the hats or jackets or glasses or shoes that make you feel like you, and how important is that to you? Also this hour, we're going to be talking about safety in taxis and ride shares, and also a dangerous trend on social media that's promoting poor parenting advice. We'll get to that. But first, as we speak, there is a town hall for staff at CSIRO where they're going to learn potentially about cuts. They're expected to learn that 100 scientists will become redundant, including 5 out of a group of 15 climate modelling specialists. Yesterday you heard researchers tell us that the climate modelling can't be done with that sort of cut, if that is confirmed, and that if it is, Australia will no longer be seen as credible in that modelling area. So what does the Federal Science Minister think about that? He joins me next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Tim Ayres, Senator and Minister for Industry and Innovation and Science. Thank you so much for joining us, Tim.
G'day, Mary. Thanks for having me on the show.
Tell me, what do you expect to happen at this meeting? Do you know?
It's important to get the roles right. Mm-hmm. Here. My job as the Minister for Science is to work with the CSIRO to make sure that they are match fit and there is a capable CSIRO for the future. It's really important in Australia's interest. That's why the government has, on top of the $1 billion or so a year that the government spends on maintaining that capability, and the previous budget and my EFO decisions that we've made to provide additional additional support, we provided in this year's budget north of $380 million.
Yeah. $387.4, I believe. So,
indeed, but that is so that there is a long term, clear way through the forwards, so that we're not returning to these sustainment questions every year.
That's the
measure of our commitment. Yeah,
obviously, that's a big commitment. $387 million, just on top of, as you say, everything else. But at the same time, you've got CSIRO sacking potentially 100 scientists on top of 818 support staff last year. So are you disappointed that that's their response?
No, the decisions about what programs continue, what programs finish, in any science organisation or university, programs begin and programs end. The CSIRO has to make decisions. It is a matter for the board and management of the CSIRO how they deliver this.
Are you happy with their priorities?
I want to see the CSIRO delivering on the national science priorities in a modern and contemporary way. They've gone through a very thorough process. The first really thorough process for 15 years of working on those priorities, consulting with staff, consulting with their union.
The union's very disappointed in the cuts, obviously. Minister, can I just...
And that doesn't mean that these aren't, these are very tough discussions, and I don't want to... But just being cautious about commenting on the specifics of it, Mary, because, today and over the course of the rest of this week, staff are being engaged by the CSIRO about those questions.
Minister, can I just put to you, though, the comments that have already been made by the people who are affected? We heard yesterday from a couple of researchers who were working with the CSIRO and supporting them in climate modelling, a small specialist team that work on modelling all our safety and our security under various scenarios. They're saying that with there are 5 of that 15 have been told that their jobs may likely be affected. So Andy Hogg is a professor of ocean and climate modelling. He's the director of Access NRI that actually does the modelling and supports CSIRO to make it. Here's what he had to say about whether or not that team could bear that cut.
I think we're getting subcritical on the real core capability that CSIRO needs to be able to perform that work.
And subcritical on... Yeah, that means that 5 out of 15 is just simply too much in your view?
Yeah, I think 15 is probably too small already, but you take away 5 of those and it really does affect our capacity to make these future projections and to understand what future climate we need to adapt to in Australia.
And another researcher also told us, Minister, that will endanger our reputation on the world stage. Are you happy with that sort of cut?
Well, what I want to see is the CSIRO delivering on those science priorities that matter for...
Why doesn't climate modelling matter as a priority?
Well, certainly when you look at the priorities for the CSIRO, addressing the pressing problem of climate change, with a focus on adaptation and resilience...
But not modelling.
Looking at the big national challenges here of deploying our solar and wind into critical metals production, grabbing
not
hold of the Australian opportunity, agriculture, all of those questions. Now, in terms of the approach to modelling, I'll let the CSIRO answer that question itself. I just say that they have to make decisions about delivering on making sure that the CSIRO, our core National Applied Science and Industrial Research Organisation, is delivering on solving the big national challenges for Australia.
Which agency does have responsibility for ensuring the high quality climate projections? Is it not the CSIRO?
Well, the CSIRO has an important role to play here, and of course, it's not the only part of government that's engaged with work on climate change. The Climate Change Authority, the Department of Environment, Climate Change and Water.
Do they do what the CSIRO has been doing?
Well, I just don't want to go to the specifics of this question because the staff are being consulted today.
It also goes to Australia's capacity to operate in these times as well.
Well, that's why we have provided additional budget support to the CSIRO to make sure that they can be the very best Australian science organisation that we need for our future.
Minister,
is the way that Australia is going to work its way through these big national challenges, whether it's on the environment and climate change side, whether it's our big energy challenges, whether it's mustering our response on artificial intelligence and quantum physics, which is in our interest, health, disease preparedness.
It's got a very large suite and in critical suite of responsibilities there. But just going to this point that the researchers have told us, will you be expecting that the CSIRO continues to take on these high-quality climate projections?
Well, I want to see them bring in capability to the whole area of climate change and
that doesn't really
resilience.
Answer the question, Minister.
And agriculture. Well, wait and see what the outcome is here. I want to respect the process that is going on here, and respect the fact that CSIRO is directly engaging with staff and their union, and has been for some months around these challenges, and understand that this is. You know, that all of these people, including people who are engaged in research programs that are not continuing, these are excellent scientists that are doing a powerful job for Australia, whether they're working at the CSIRO or our other national science institutions, that what they are really valued. It is a tough, that is always a tough set of circumstances. But for the government's part, our job here is providing leadership for the CSIRO and making sure that they have got the budget envelope that puts them on a sustainable pathway, and that we're working with them in all sorts of ways to make sure that they are match fit and fit for purpose for what is a very challenging set of circumstances for Australia, part of which our response to climate change, energy challenges, all of the long list that I went through with you before, part of it is publicly funded science working with industry to solve big national challenges.
You're listening to Tim Ayres, who's Minister for Science and Industry and Innovation. Minister, also in the budget were the details that are the cutting of the Australia's Economic Accelerator Program. That's the one that was established a few years ago that, quote unquote, supports the translation of research into real-world economic and social benefits. It's been cut in order to, among other things, move money into the CSIRO. And there are plenty of researchers who are saying this is just cutting off our nose to spite our face. What would you have to say to them?
Yeah, there are a range of programs that work in this area, including programs in my own portfolio. It is a budget where we have had to make tough choices, where the Albanese government has had to make choices to make sure that we've got a sound budget that delivers for the future. Some programs have not continued, and that is one of them. But we are as a government, whether it's our National Reconstruction Fund investing in Australian science and research commercialised here in Australia, our other programs in particularly in my portfolio arena, a range of these vehicles.
There's a lot on your plate, but the part of the criticism from the people who are obviously going to suffer from that decision is that you can't talk about building a future made in Australia, they say, while you actually are cutting a research commercialisation program at that scale.
Well, this is a budget that has really delivered for Australian research and development and commercialisation and innovation.
Cutting the program?
Well, yeah. I mean, some programs get smaller, some programs get cut. There are new opportunities here. The research and development tax incentive, for example, has been substantially modified to mean that we have more higher impact private research. Our CRC programs continue providing support for industry partnerships that go to exactly those kind of challenges, you know, making sure that we've got the new science that we can commercialise here in Australia. We're continuing with that work as well in the agriculture sector. Our National Reconstruction Fund arena, all of these vehicles are at the cutting edge of the intersection between publicly funded science, privately funded research and development, and making sure that we are commercialising these inventions, this intellectual property, this science onshore here in Australia to create good jobs in outer suburbs and in our industrial regions. That's what that agenda is all about. And I understand, of course, that when a particular program closes, that's disappointing for the people who are engaged in it. But
and particularly for people who've been trying to apply for these grants. You know, it's a waste of their time.
Australian scientists and researchers are trying their guts out, are working hard and often working in an environment where there are competitive grants processes. And, of course, it's disappointing when even though your program, you know, you're an excellent scientist or researcher, you've got an exciting program, not all programs get funded. I mean, in the medical research area, which is a substantial area of public investment in Australian science and Australian research that leads to new products and new jobs and new economic development, it's a competitive process. That has been the way that it has always been, but it's a tough process. So people often forget that there are many more applications than there are successful grants, right?
There are many competing priorities. Minister, I'm really grateful for your time.
Thanks, Mary. Good on you. Bye.
That Senator Tim Ayres, Minister for Industry, Innovation and Minister for Science. And you've been texting in. Ina says, climate change, rabbit plague, land degradation. What does the management of CSIRO think their priorities are? How can we afford to lose any scientists? Georgie says it's quite clear that the future main issue for the CSIRO is focused on foreseeable pandemics. It must be serious if climate science is no longer near the top of the list. A few texts about interviewing politicians and not answering the questions. What did you think of that interview? What did you think of the senator there? Let me know. I have had word that the cuts we here are going through as planned. That's been announced for the staff at CSIRO. But that town hall is still in progress. That's not confirmed. But, of course, we will continue to follow this story and see what the response is as well. Coming up next, what do you think about when you dress? Is it your identity? Is it about expressing yourself? I want to know. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Coming up next, you're going to meet someone. I am going to meet someone that I am really fascinated by, Kate Bell, who's been on the catwalk in various ways and in front of the camera, and she's still modelling into her 50s.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
I love this on text. If I mention scarf, earrings and lipstick to identify myself on the phone, people say, oh yes, I know who you are. How do you dress? Do you dress to express yourself? Is that the last thing you think of? What's the item of clothing that makes you feel like you? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Very soon we are going to be talking to Kate Bell. I've got lots of questions for her. It'd be a great conversation. Malcolm, I believe you're on the line. What did you want? You wanted to talk about my interview with Minister for Science?
I was really disappointed with that interview. I'm not sure what minister it was, but whoever it was. It sounded like question time. You were asking a question, and you were very specific and very intelligent questions, and all you got was word salads. And I'm just over this. I try to listen to Question Time to find out what's going on, and you get all this double talk, and here you are. You're asking sensible, intelligent questions, and you didn't get any clear answers.
Malcolm, I'll take that as a comment and not a question, and good on you for watching Question Time. Do you do that every day?
I do it a fair bit, but I'd have to say to you lately, I've had to turn it off because I've been so frustrated because the questions that have been like, are so straightforward that my grandchildren can answer.
Yeah.
And yet the politicians don't want to answer more. Or it's all this silly sarcasm, again, which I think denigrates the whole situation with the Senate and Parliament, because there's no place for sarcasm and childish behaviour. We just need some
Do you think it's getting better or worse or the same, Malcolm? Has it always been thus?
I think it's getting worse. It's getting back into the days Mr. Keating was the Prime Minister. It's sort of getting down to that level, and I don't like it. They're here to do a job, and they need to do better.
Oh, Malcolm, they should maybe hand out some sort of, you know, medical gear to monitor your blood pressure, I think, if you're watching Question Time on a regular basis. Thank you so much for calling in. Also, this on text, yes, cuts to CSIRO, disgusting, very, very disappointed in Labor. Sorry, I voted for them. And so upset to hear the weasel words. Keep those thoughts coming through. I'd love to continue that conversation. Right now, we're going to meet someone very special. She caught my eye in Fashion Week. It wasn't just the outfits making headlines. It was apparently this woman's face, apart from anything else and others. It shouldn't be that way. But Kate Bell was there strutting her stuff. She's been smashing down barriers her whole career, championing not just women our age, but also is passionate about dressing as a form of self-expression. So I want to hear her thoughts on that. Kate Bell joins me now. Hi, Kate.
Hello, Mary.
I was so happy to read. I was, you know, enraged that it even was a story, right? That, you know, oh, wow, yeah. Older women on a runway. But really, really wanted to talk with you about that experience, about your career and your thoughts on fashion. What did it mean for you to walk down the runway during Fashion Week?
Look, for 40 years I've sort of been wanting, like, trying to make modelling meaningful, and it's been a sort of a difficult journey. But for the last probably 17 years, it has become very purposeful because I realised it was about visibility for more mature women in fashion and advertising. And so this year at Australian Fashion Week, for me personally, it was just thrilling that I walked 7 shows. And,
What was the reaction? Tell us about that.
I'm talking to you here now. It's been quite a big reaction. I mean, there have been mature women walking shows in Australian Fashion Week previously. But this year was the second year that the Australian Fashion Council has, it's come back to Australia, basically. We're not sending all our money offshore to the larger corporations that have had their claws in for the last sort of decade in Australian Fashion Week. So it's been a very Australian Fashion Week, and that's really shown in the inclusiveness of the choice of casting. It's just getting better and better, and Australia is actually leading that in the world.
Is that right?
I travel for work. Yes, which is...
In terms of all diversity or, at older ages?
Yes. So overseas in the markets, there's been a lot of diversity in sort of cultural backgrounds of the models. But here we've had age diversity very early on. Different types of people, the skinny white young females. We've had different sorts of people on the runway, and that's really new to the world as well. Yeah.
So you started in the late 80s, I believe, at 17. Tell us about the attitude to ageing that you have seen develop. When did it actually start to change then? Is it relatively recently?
Yes, probably about... I've been... in my late 30s, I was working in London, based in London, in the world's first mature model agency.
Oh.
So that's what...
How old did you have
ago.
To be?
You had to be over 30.
30.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I even was mature at 30, I'll be honest.
but previously to that, models' ages were 18 to 25.
18 to 25. And that's how, and 26, you had to just hang up the stilettos.
Well, I suppose a lot of, women do, we have children and we have families and perhaps other things take place.
So what about you? Why did you keep going?
I didn't have children.
Right.
I think it's a big reason. I really think it's a big reason. But also I've just always been completely fascinated with that industry. I was like that as a child, as a teenager, and then stepping into that whole arena of creativity and clothes, and it was just my vibe. And also not meaning to step into that, but a place where people could be themselves. There are a lot of gay people working in the industry. There still is. And I think it was a really safe space to sort of just be whatever you wanted to be, even though you were still being a professional. Like, it's not uncommon, and it's never been uncommon to sort of turn around in a workspace, in a studio space, and see someone having a little dance, over in the corner.
Kate!
And oh, good, they're at work.
listening to Kate Bell, by the way, if you're just tuning in, Australian model for, into her 50s, I'm going to say, from 17.
40 years of modelling.
40 years of modelling. And still smashing it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. You're painting such a good picture of modelling. I'll be honest, I think a lot of people outside modelling, see the problems and the pressures, especially on women.
It's had a really bad rap, and personally, it's been because there's been this sort of push and shove against the male lens that sort of we saw as advertising that we're mostly men working in the industry, mostly men making decisions, and fashion and beauty was touted to women as a tool of seduction.
Mm.
And I think over the last 20 years, women have just wised up, and it's like, yeah, it's like, no, actually, I want to sort of create myself looking like this or try looking like that. And it's got nothing to do with being for a man.
Yeah,
it's about self-presentation and exploration and also professionalism. I think clothes are all of those things. Yeah,
so we're asking people, 1300 222 774 is the number to call if you want to say, tell us your wardrobe as self-expression story. Tell us what makes you feel like you. 1300 222 774. Already got this on text, Kate. Metallica t-shirt, mm-hmm. Hawthorne jumper, hooded short sleeve, leather Brando metal jacket, ripped jeans, steel capped Blundstones. I've got a very specific picture here.
That's fantastic. You can wear that all your life. Like, you could just like be 17 and wear that, and you can be like 80 and wear that, and that's great. And
how's it changed for you?
Yeah.
Do you do that? I mean, you've had beautiful clothes, obviously, to wear. Did that hasten or did that hinder your ability to express yourself?
Good question, Mary. So I went into the industry with like wearing all sorts of weird and wonderful things, and then just I felt all of a sudden very, that whole thing of do I have the right thing on? And there's been this fashion snobbery that I really have never understood.
In yourself or in others?
Just in others. I don't think that style is a measure of a person. Everyone has different aesthetics, and that's why I really love Australia. There's all sorts of different Australians, and we have Middle Eastern influence, we have Asian influence, we have all different types of aesthetics, and that's, I think, to be embraced, because we do have sort of, I mean, I love a sparkle and I really do, a sparkle and a shine, and I'm sure it comes from my Russian grandmother,
I mean, there'd be people listening who think, I get up and I just have to do whatever I have to do. What would you say to them about, I guess, what you get from thinking about fashion as a form of self-expression internally?
I think it expresses a lot about the way that you want to be seen. Mm. And I'm not saying that you dress for other people, but you dress to be the self that you want to be seen as.
Mm.
And so therefore, you can have lots of views. You can have, the one that goes to work because they know that this costume really suits that environment.
Mm.
And then, you know what I mean? And then you can play and then, but when I go out on Friday night, I'm this person.
Exactly.
And I think it's true, right? And I think that that sort of theatre, that sort of play is sometimes overlooked. And I also think that fashion has been really overlooked because it's been considered like this women's thing. It's not that important.
Yeah.
It's a really odd way of thinking about it. And that's trickled down into, especially in Australia too, like in France, it's got its own, concert general or whatever that really is part of the economic, program of the country. So I think in Australia, it's always been considered a bit silly, a bit sort of frivolous, a bit women's business sort of thing.
Kate,
and so we haven't had government support and government, yeah. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. In terms of the government support for these really important things, I was just going to point out to you that I think Emma from Belmont agrees with you about the importance of dressing well. Is that right, Emma?
Mm-hmm. Hi. Yes, hi.
Hello, Emma.
I've always believed that a woman should be able to feel that she should be able to dress however she wants to.
How would you describe your identity, Emma?
I do interior design, but Even when I was a kid, I used to wear unusual clothes. I used to go to op shops and find unusual pieces of clothing. Mm. And in some ways, it sort of annoys you sometimes when you go to into fashion, because my son's a fashion designer. But he likes really unusual, quirky things that's not that's outside the box. All I'm saying is women should not feel that once they get to a certain age that they have to be wearing quiet clothing and bag dresses
and so on. Tell us about it then. Is it the sparkles that get you? Is it, you know, feathers? Is it colour? What is it?
Absolutely everything, sparkles. I love sparkles. All the brooches coming back into fashion. It's amazing. Yeah. I love it.
Good on you, Emma. I can visualise you, Emma, and it's glorious. It's great to hear that, isn't it, Kate?
No, definitely. Yeah, I'm glad other people feel the same way.
Exactly. This as well, you were talking about dressing for work. Georgie says, fashion identity for me, Mary, has always been amazing. Shoes and colour. Colour in the corporate world is often used as power dressing. It's the politics also of what we wear, isn't it, when it comes to the meaning that we imbue in others and for ourselves. Kate, it's been absolutely fantastic to talk to you today. Really appreciate it. I feel like we could get you on for a five other topics, but really, I'm really appreciative of your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
That's Kate Bell, international and Australian model. She's been just lately at Australian Fashion Week up on the runway and strutting her stuff. Jim from Elwood says he worked in the fashion industry for 35 years when appearance was important. But now I no longer feel the need to impress. At 77, I now have a uniform of jeans and workwear-inspired shirts, nothing more. Yeah, I guess it's about shrugging off an identity as well. Caroline, you've called in from Caulfield. I'm not going to say, tell me what you're wearing.
the thing you read out just then about wearing jeans and what have you, I am absolutely the opposite.
Right.
I would no sooner come to, I'm going to walk around the park in a minute. I have lipstick on. That's my war paint. I don't want people to see me looking shocking, you know, unkempt.
Exactly. It was manners once, wasn't it, Caroline, to not leave the house without a bit of lipstick on?
Manners maketh woman.
Exactly. And do you dress up as well? You wouldn't wear jeans?
I don't have a pair of jeans. I've lost 20 kilo and my jeans fell off me. So maybe I'll buy a pair of jeans, maybe I won't.
You might need a pair of skinny jeans, Caroline.
Maybe. But I have one particular shop where I go and I can ring up, she'll say, what are you looking for? And by the time I get there, 20 things are on a rack for me to try on. And so I've formed a relationship.
That's fantastic, isn't it?
I like to look, the old-fashioned word is smart.
Smart. I love it. Smart slacks, smart jackets.
And war paint.
Good on you, Caroline. I too love a bit of war paint, even when I am walking the dog. Thanks for calling in. Del says, definitely colour for me. I love dopamine dressing. The older I get, the less I worry about what others think. I agree, Del. I think I've gone veering towards some very loud shirts. I could take on Dr. Carl with some of my shirts. I think that's my identity into my late 50s. And this, I'm comfy, I feel good, a bloke in late 50s who's always hated T-shirts, track pants and wind cheaters, finally found who I am, 1930s, 40s influenced chinos, proper shoes, collars, cardigans and hats. Good on you, that texter. I have a very smart vision in my head of you. Also earlier in the program, we were speaking to the science minister, still getting some texts about that. This on texts that expecting the minister to undermine the process underway is naive because new programs replace old, skills and technological needs evolve, wait for them to announce the changes. but also many texts along these lines saying that it was waffle and that what's happening at CSIRO is disastrous. Let me know what you think. 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or 0437 774 774. Let's also talk now, though, about how you feel in taxis and ride shares. What have been your experiences? Do you keep safe? Do you feel safe? What do you do to keep safe in those taxis and ride share vehicles?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
What is thought to be Australia's very first study looking at the experiences that we have when it comes to harassment and harmful behaviour in taxis and rideshare services has just been carried out. Bianca Philiborn is one of the researchers, a criminologist who's been looking into it and can tell us about the somewhat disturbing results. Thanks for joining us, Bianca.
Hi, Mary.
I'm inviting people to call 1300 222 774 to tell me how safe you feel in taxis and ride shares, your experience as well. Bianca, you did an online survey among passengers. What did you find?
Yeah, so we found a few things. So we asked people about how safe they usually feel when they're using taxi and rideshare services. I think the good news is that most of the time people were telling us that they do feel safe using these services, which is fantastic. On the flip side, we did ask people about their experiences of different forms of sexual harassment, sexual violence, and other types of interpersonal violence. And we found that 58% of our participants had reported at least one harmful experience, either in a taxi or rideshare. 58%. And that was predominantly sexual harassment. So some of the most common things were, you know, unwanted staring or leering, you know, unwanted attempts to flirt, unwanted comments about people's physical appearance or their sexual lives or their romantic relationships.
Wow, 58% is—it's almost a figure I'm wanting mentally to push back against. I guess I don't want to believe it's true. Is there any aspect you, as a researcher, would understand about negativity bias, that people who who have had a bad experience are more likely to fill out that sort of survey? How much do you trust those numbers?
Absolutely. We should stress this was a small scale survey, so they're not representative findings. And absolutely, we do know that people who've had experiences of harassment and violence are perhaps more likely to share their experiences. Nonetheless, we do know more broadly and from really large scale surveys like the Australian Bureau of Statistics Personal Safety Survey that sexual harassment is a very, very pervasive occurrence. So,
and not meant to diminish. 1% is too many.
Exactly. So, you know, while we can't really speak to, you know, is this representative of everyone who's using rideshare and taxi services, it nonetheless, I think, points to some very concerning experiences that really require serious attention and response.
You're listening to Bianca Philiborn, who has carried out what's believed to be Australia's first study looking into sexual and interpersonal violence in taxis and rideshare. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1300 222 774. You mentioned a whole range of things that fit into that category, not just the most extreme things like, you know, violence, physical violence, but leering and flirting and so forth. Why is it important to have this study, and what would you like to see out of it when it comes to this sort of behaviour?
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, we know these experiences are really harmful. So I think it can be tempting to sort of say, oh, what's the big deal? But it's very, very clear, both from our study and other research that's been done, that these experiences, you know, cause participants who are mostly women to feel afraid, to have concerns for their safety. We know that people avoid actually using these services because of their experiences in some cases. So, you know, we are talking about experiences that have very real impact, and that can really shape people's ability to just, you know, to move around and to go about their daily lives. So they do really require us to take them seriously.
And they're harder to report. Presumably.
That's right. They're very often very subtle experiences. Some forms of behaviour, you know, don't meet criminal thresholds of harm, for example. So it's often very difficult for people who experience them to actually do anything in response. And I think these are. Oh, sorry, Mary, you go.
No, please.
We know as well that these are contexts that can feel quite vulnerable if you're a passenger, right? Like you're often alone with a driver. They have control over where you're going. And I think that can shape how these interactions are experienced as well. It was a context that could be associated with a loss of control and a sense of fear. Mm. We also know that people often use them perhaps when they've been out for a few drinks. So that can also, I guess, add to the potential vulnerability. Mm. That said, I do want to stress, we know that drivers also are very vulnerable to different forms of violence and harassment. So I want to recognise that. We're certainly not trying to demonise drivers of these services.
No, absolutely. That's another study. That wasn't this study, but yes, violence on either side, not a good thing. Bianca Philiborne is with you. We're talking about the study that you've done. Bianca, you obviously have found out also what women in particular are doing to keep themselves safe. This on text, a friend of mine said she downloaded a man's voice who sounds like he's talking to you, so the driver of the taxi or Uber thinks you're on the phone to your partner if you are feeling uncomfortable. How much are women in particular doing these sort of mitigating, I guess, hopefully preventative measures?
We know that these types of measures are really, really common. They're just things that become, routine patterns in women's lives. So certainly we had people talking to us about how they would phone a partner or a friend if they were using a taxi or rideshare service. Yeah. People spoke about only sitting in the back seat so that there was some physical distance between them and the driver, or pretending that they had a partner that they were going home to, particularly if they were actually going home alone. Some people spoke about not actually getting dropped off at their actual address. They might get dropped off around the corner so that the driver didn't know where they were, where they actually lived. So these types of strategies are really, really just ingrained in women's everyday lives.
Yeah. Bianca, is it part of your research, or whether through this study or others, to look at what would be the most practical changes that could make the biggest difference in this area?
Yeah, so we did ask people about the types of responses that they would like. So I think one really key finding was that the vast majority of people were not reporting these experiences either to the taxi and rideshare companies or to police. I think there was really a sort of sense of futility around, nothing will actually be done. So I think there was a real desire for clear reporting pathways, particularly to the companies themselves, but also for a sense of transparency and accountability. So, for people that have reported, these reports often went off to Uber or the relevant company, and then they just never heard anything again. And particularly in the Australian context, we actually don't have a clear sense of what's being reported to these companies and what response is being taken, in the aftermath of reports. So I think a really key thing that came out was just that need for transparency and accountability from these companies. There were also calls for a national register of drivers so that there's actually a way to be able to identify if someone's had multiple...
There's no national register of drivers?
No, not that we're aware of, and certainly not that's actually capturing reports of these types of behaviour.
Bianca, thank you for joining us and taking us through your findings.
No problems, Mary.
That's Bianca Philiborne, Associate Professor and a criminologist at Melbourne University, talking about that. Coming up very soon, we're going to be talking about a pretty disturbing trend on social media that encourages co-sleeping with babies. That big no-no that we've been told about for some time. What's behind this push on social media? Have you seen it? And what do you think? 1300 222 774. Also, we've been talking about expressing yourself through fashion. I love this. Mary, I dropped in on my 90-year-old mother-in-law once, and there she was, mowing her lawn, dressed in track pants and a string of pearls. I love that. This on text as well. Once a young woman came up to me and told me how much she'd admired me with the beautiful clothes and henna-dyed hair for 20 years.
absolutely terrific. I'm getting some really great mental images here. And this, I've always dressed exactly in what clothes I wanted, didn't care what anyone thought. I was happy with how I look because, honestly, I was individual. I'd love for you to keep telling me as well how you express yourself in your dress. But it's coming up to 10 minutes to 12. Let's talk about some pretty disturbing trends on social media.
Ali Moore. I just want to say I'm going to miss you. I'm quite shocked and devastated to hear that you are leaving because I learned a lot from you. Those questions that I want to ask them, you really ask them.
From 3 on 774 ABC Melbourne. This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
On social media, there has been a trend, and over a few years it seems, to promote sleeping with your baby. And as we know, that can be fatal. So experts have been sounding the alarm about it. Lorraine Rushton is National Prevention and Education Manager at Red Nose and joins us now. Hi, Lorraine.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this trend and where it's come from.
Yes, absolutely. So the trend sort of has come from, a lot of parents have expressing the need and want to co-sleep with their little ones. And we here at Red Nose definitely understand that it comes from a cultural background. Some parents are wanting to co-sleep for ease of breastfeeding, and some parents wanting to do it from more of that sort of parenting choice. And so we're seeing a lot of that sort of coming up when on social media from influencers, and also it's starting to appear more in sort of AI-generated data as well. So
people are using AI to generate this sort of data promoting co-sleeping?
We're seeing that coming through. If you're typing in that sort of information, it's definitely generating a lot more of that messaging and a lot more of that imaging as production as well. And that's definitely coming through on social media as well.
Do you think that it's a failure then? Red Nose is obviously famous and has had so much of an impact in this space. But is this indicating that the message is waning or getting old in people's minds?
No, definitely not. I think what's happening is that people are just using the social media as a platform to sort of really voice what's happening in the households. And, Red Nose are definitely aware that co-sleeping does happen. And, although we have our messaging stating that Red Nose don't encourage and recommend co-sleeping for the first 12 months because we are aware that it is one of the main risk factors for SUDI deaths, we do know that only 21.5% of co-sleeping that occurs is planned co-sleeping. So that means 77.5% actually occurs unintentionally. Mm. So for many years, we've actually had, if people are going to be co-sleeping, either planned or unplanned, we've developed a resource on if co-sleeping is going to occur, how to do so more safely. So for those parents who in the middle of the night, they bring baby in to do feeding, we want them to set themselves up and the environment and space in a more safe way so that if they do happen to fall asleep, it's going to be a safer setup for co-sleeping than it would be had they not previously accessed our resources.
So for people who are listening who might want just a quick rundown on how that happens, what are you advising people to do to mitigate against the risk?
I would definitely advise people to go onto the Red Nose website, access our Safe Sleeping Co-Sleeping resource, and just have a look at what that information states. So it's things like how to set up your environment, so your bed, which would remove things like pillows, blankets, and set up baby's own sleeping space should you happen to fall asleep. And it just removes any of those additional risks. So not doing things like putting your bed up against the wall, removing any furniture around your bed where babies could potentially become trapped, And doing things like, if you are going to be co-sleeping, really having a think about your own mattress. We talk a lot about the firmness mattress of an infant's cot. And there's a special testing method for that, but we don't think about that in an adult mattress. Mm. And that's a big risk factor for the babies.
You're listening to Loren Rushton, who's from Red Nose, and we're talking about what you've been seeing on social media that, if not has been, what you're saying, Loren, is that it's not potentially even, some people are not advocating this, it's just the photos of, you know, the sweet sleeping photos that people innocently take, if you like, and then put up on their feed. Are you planning, or is Red Nose planning to counter this in any way, or this has been going on for some years? Is there something that Red Nose is planning?
We definitely are planning a co-sleeping campaign towards the end of the year. We are doing a more deeper dive into the research around co-sleeping. We're doing a national data approach on a coroner's data on the infant deaths, and really looking at individual cases as to what has been in those environments. So currently, there's only the state-by-state reviews that occur. The Red Nose are looking at a 10-year data review at a national level, which is the first of its kind. And that's going to really help us to really develop more resources in this sort of co-sleeping prevention space. As I said, Red Nose definitely do not recommend co-sleeping for the first 12 months. That is the safest option for babies to be in their own sleep space in the cot. However, like I said, we know it occurs, and therefore we do have some safer co-sleeping guidelines on our website.
Thank you, Loren. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Anytime.
Loren Rushton is with Red Nose as National Prevention and Education Manager. We've been talking about fashion and self-expression. Fiona says, I'm always getting compliments for my punky feminine fashion choice, jewellery and wild hair, and I always compliment women and men for their outfits. And Libby is driving around Ballarat, absolutely a tracky dax, thermals and fleece type of girl because I spend so much time out there. Not sure my outfitting is about creating any sort of image, but does reflect my lifestyle and commitments. Thank you so much for joining me today. Still getting texts about how you express yourself. Alison says, I love watching fashion in all the ways. I save up for big purchases and try to buy classics. This, instead of yummy mummy dressing, I've heartily embraced my inner scummy mummy. I dress for comfort. I'm always completely covered. I can dress up, but I don't usually bother. That's what I love. Everyone, go out there, be yourselves today, whether it's frocking up or in your tracky decks.